Hello and welcome to Wooden Spoons on CKUW 95.9 FM. My name is John Dick, and I'm here with community nutritionist Mary Jane Eason to discuss topics of healthy living, environmental issues, what's going on in our community, as well as other interesting things in this one-hour show. On Wooden Spoons, we recognize that all things are related, and with learning and awareness, we connect the dots that make up our world. Every Friday morning on Wooden Spoons, we speak with guests on today's relevant issues, share nutritious recipes, and explore important topics with perspectives not found in mainstream media. Time right now is 8:01 a.m. and the temperature outside is minus 13. Good morning, Mary Jane.
Good morning, John. How are you this morning?
I'm doing pretty well. You?
Good. I think we've been having some problems trying to figure out what dates we're on.
Oh, yeah.
You thought it was the 12th today.
Yeah, I'm getting my dates mixed up a little bit.
And then with all the switching around between Mary Ann Sorelli and our program on Wooden Spoons, I just want to acknowledge that, again, on Wooden Spoons, that we are located on Treaty 1 territory, the traditional land, water, and water of the Cree, Ojibwe Cree, Dakota, and Dene people, as well as the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis homeland. We also acknowledge the Shoal Lake Number 40 First Nation and its territory for life-giving water. Just to have a brief rundown of what we're going to be doing today, we're going to be interviewing our guest this morning is Reverend David Dreger, and that'll be for the first part of the program. And as time permits, I'll be offering some information by Dr. Meg Sears on glyphosate, and also on Dr. Joseph McCullough. We will be following up with a recipe at the end of the program, as time permits. So, on that note, I would like to introduce our guest, David Dreger. He is the leading minister of First Mennonite Church in the West End of Winnipeg, and also a theologian who speaks and writes about the intersection of faith and politics. He wrote a book titled Nothing Will Save Us, A Theology of Immeasurable Life. The book covers a wide range of topics. And there's a beautiful foreword written by Steve Henrich from Winnipeg. And I also, when I saw that name, I thought, that name is very familiar. And so I remembered interviewing a Steve Henrich at some point in time. And so I checked all the, because I keep a record of all the interviews I have. And going back to 2018, Steve Henrich was a guest on our radio program. And he was... He was titled Reverend Steve Henrichs, Director of Indigenous Settlers Relations, and it was on April 20th, 2018, he was arrested and sentenced to 7 days in jail in Coquitlam, B.C. for protesting against the Trans Mountain Pipeline. So that, I just wanted to add that information about that person that did the foreword in the book for Dave Dreger. So good morning, Dave.
He hasn't signed on yet. I'm trying to email him to get him on, but...
Oh, okay. Well, that is an interesting situation. You did send him the information. I know I was trying to...
Yeah, it might have been buried in his email. I don't know. I might have sent it a little too early, though. That's the problem.
Okay, well, we'll just wait a little bit and see what happens. It's, let's see. I know that I did send him the email, and I had gotten the dates a little bit straight, a little bit mixed up. But then I confirmed that it was okay. Today is December the 5th, so We'll just wait a little bit and see how what happens here. I wonder. I wonder if we should play a song while we're waiting.
Yeah, I've already got one booted up. Take 5, Dave Brubeck.
Okay, and I have another song I'd like to suggest that is very appropriate.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. How do I know he's on?
Should say hello, David. Can you hear us?
I see the
okay,
name.
Just yep. I can hear you. Let me just.
Okay, well, we can proceed with the interview if you're all set to go. Hi, Dave.
Okay.
Yeah. So I did a bit of an introduction, a little bit of. I've made a few statements about Steve Heinrichs, who I had interviewed a number of years ago, and he was titled Reverend Steve Heinrichs, Director of Indigenous Settlers Relations, and he was working with First Nations and so on. And apparently on April the 20th, 2018, he was arrested and sentenced to 7 days in jail in Coquitlam, B.C. for protesting against the Trans Mountain Pipeline. So he's a minister and also a very, he's an activist for the people. So I just wanted to share that as well. So I will introduce you now, David. And David is the former pastor. He was a former pastor in the Carrier Territory. Oh, this is the sorry. I've got the wrong person here. Okay. David is the leading minister of First Mennonite Church in the West End of Winnipeg, and also a theologian who speaks and writes about the intersection of faith and politics. He wrote a book titled Nothing Will Save Us, A Theology of Immeasurable Life. The book covers a wide range of topics, and there was a beautiful foreword written by Steve Heinrichs from Winnipeg, who I just was describing. And I did enjoy the book very much. So welcome to Wooden Spoons, Dave.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. So I found that the writing in the book just flows with concepts and ideas that are full of richness. And the foreword of the book includes recognition of Thomas Merton, a Trappist monk from Louisville, Kentucky. I think he was well known in the 1960s. And the writings of Dante Alighieri, who lived from 1308 to 1322, whose book, The Inferno, was written. And it's a major masterpiece. And you stated that Dante's writing became a helpful metaphor for your book. So would you comment on that?
Sure. Yeah. So I was in the later stages of finishing the book, and the writings themselves form. There's the chapters are in part two and three sort of independent chapters, and were written over a period of 5 to 10 years. And as I was finishing, I was concerned the book is quite critical of several things, both in society and in the church. And I was feeling like, oh, is this just too pessimistic or too critical? And at the time, with a friend, I was in a small reading group reading Dante's Divine Comedy and reading The Inferno, and just sort of realized that Dante had many criticisms of his own time and place, and that part of that was kind of going through that process of judgment and finding an adequate way to assess and sometimes be critical of society. And so I found it encouraging that other people too sort of have to pass through. And in The Inferno, you know, Dante, what I expect was how many sort of local people are named in there, and not to just criticize them, but just that Dante was processing a lot of the details of his own time and place. And I took some encouragement that others have to kind of go through that path as well.
Yeah, and it's kind of an acknowledgement of the fact that your book was touched people. And if you didn't get any negative comments or whatever, then it meant that it really didn't have much of an impact, perhaps. You know, there's another way of looking at that. So that's probably a good sign that you receive some criticisms, because that's the way it is with the world, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just a brief station ID. We're listening to CQW 95.9 FM, and this is Wooden Spoons. And our guest this morning is Reverend David Dreger from First Mennonite Church, and our co-host here is John Dick, who's an expert in all the technology.
I mean, yeah, I wouldn't say expert, but, you know.
Well, certainly you're the mainstay of getting this program on the air, John. Also noteworthy is the decision, Dave, that you made to refrain from upward mobility and remain in the West End of Winnipeg. And the cover of your book features a building with... It's sort of faded, but it features a building with a large sign saying "Discount Everything," located next door to where you live, which, by the way, since burned down and was next door to you. The next door fire caused some damage to your home, and there have been many examples of arson in your neighborhood, and you have made a deliberate effort to help those in the neighborhood, which include people who have stolen goods. And I gathered from your writing that the saying "nothing will save us" refers to those who have nothing, the poor and disenfranchised, those who are neglected and forgotten and not being taken seriously. And so they are the ones that are spiritually important. The rest is idolatry. And I'm kind of just quoting what you said. Do you want to comment on that?
Sure. Yeah. I think this is, you know, over time, that's how I've come to understand basically what the gospel is. So we're in Advent now, we're approaching the Christmas season, and it's that constant reminder that in Christian theology, the God who created, you know, heaven and earth, the all-powerful, became someone of no account, became an illegitimate child born in a back lane, and that it's to one like this that we're called to give our attention. And so this is a theme, you know, throughout the New Testament, and theme in the prophets and in the law in the Old Testament. Yeah, this is how I've come to understand how we're supposed to, if we're supposed to seek God and supposed to understand what the good news is, we can only do that by paying attention to those who are discounted and not considered of worth and value by the world's standards. So yeah, that's really a founding orientation for my theology.
And it's very powerful, for sure. When you began writing this book, you explored many scholarly writings, and there is a sense of dialogue going on that includes many citations of various authors. And do you want to comment on the many authors that you have included in your book as citations?
Sure. Yeah, I think a major... thinker that influenced me is Philip Goodchild, who is a professor in the UK, and he helped draw a lot of parallels between sort of the ancient world's understanding of religion and modern understanding of religion as in relation to modern economics and economic structure, in that you know, when you think of a religious system, you know, with a God that is to be worshipped, it is to that God that we turn our attention. We believe that God helps establish the values that are most important, and that we devote ourselves to. And in a modern economic system, you know, we have things are valued in terms of money, Our labor, you know, requires us to give our attention to this system. And so it becomes its own structure of sort of ultimate value in a way that religion has in other times and places and still does. And so Philip Goodchild helped me think in those terms. And then there would be a cluster of thinkers in sort of what I would call sort of the psychoanalytic tradition, which I found helpful. Even though psychoanalysis in its origin, certainly with Freud, was an atheistic approach to the world, I always was compelled by this idea of the unconscious, that there are things within us that we'll never fully understand, that sort of escape our conscious awareness. And that's in some ways helps me to think a little bit about God as that which is within us but beyond our, and at work in us but beyond our full understanding. And so a lot of those writers have really helped me give shape to some of my thinking in the book as well.
Yeah, because you certainly have cited a lot of different writings in your book. And you have also acknowledged that St. Margaret's Anglican Church, located in the Wolseley area, played a pivotal role in your faith and intellectual development by offering a model of faith that was not rigid or secular. And would you comment on the experience you had at St. Margaret's Church, what the experience had on you? And just to mention that my husband used to attend St. Margaret's Church. They were doing some, I think it was a meditation group or discussion sessions, and he really enjoyed going to that. So, yeah, I'd like you to comment on that church. It's in our neighborhood.
Sure. Yeah, so I would have attended there. I mean, that's getting to be over 25 years ago now, and so it was as a young person coming out of a rural and more conservative religious context, I found the way they engaged faith and thought and sort of more intellectual understanding, but also a deep sense of the traditions of the church was just sort of a new experience of church for me that I hadn't had before. And it encouraged a number of my interests at that time. I think that chapter was in the book was interesting because in the end I'm ultimately quite critical of St. Margaret's, not in distinction from other churches. I think most churches kind of fall into this tendency is that over time I felt its theology was a little bit too comfortable with sort of the larger, you know, kind of Western and British colonial project that sort of ultimately felt that Christendom and the church's project of Western civilization, there was a bit too much comfort there with that. And I didn't find it maybe able to critically engage some of the topics I have. So it's a mixed chapter where I certainly want to affirm kind of the support that I had when I was there, but also some concerns that emerged over time my time there.
Okay, just speaking of St. Margaret's, they've been hosting the farmers markets in the summer because at the time with the place on Palmerston Avenue, up Palmerston, they couldn't they were under construction, the building that used to host it. And so St. Margaret's took over, and they had all the farmers markets selling their goods on their property. So that it turns out to be a very good space, and they don't want to go back to the other place. Sure. I can't remember; it's a community center. So your book offers considerable commentary on the signing of treaties with the British government, which colonized Canada, not to mention other countries or continents as well. And you note that the Confederation of Canada, the Indian Act, and the establishment of residential schools provided a legal framework for cultural genocide. So do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, that's a big topic.
I know.
I I appreciated digging into that topic a little bit more for the book. And so you mentioned Steve Heinrichs earlier. And so also to note, so he's a good friend and neighbor. He's just across, lives just across the street on Ellis.
So say we hello talked... to him. He may so, not remember. But anyway, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, no, very good. I appreciated talking with him because he has a really deep knowledge of a lot of these histories as well. And it was interesting that in a lot of the early contacts with European traders before, you know, Canada was really established, there are a number of stories where you could see there were alternatives to what became the Canadian project. There was opportunities for potentially more mutuality, where Indigenous communities had more sway or more of a voice and more authority in that relationship, or mutual authority at times. And then to see how when Canada began to really establish itself as a nation-building project, that began to undermine a lot of those things. I mean, we see that here in Manitoba's history, where the Métis people were the potential of a different kind of way of understanding a nation. It was a nation that emerged from that the relationship between Indigenous and Europeans. And so once, you know, you see the need to establish sovereignty for the Canadian project, then all of those the treaties, the relationships, they seem to have gotten undermined by the Canadian agenda to hold sole sovereignty over the land. And so that was, you know, certainly the history of Indian residential schools and the Indian Act were the way to sort of encode that so that it became, you know, what I talk about as structural sin or systemic injustice, that it's regardless of the goodwill of individuals, the system itself is working towards a particular end.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Métis people, and under Louis Riel, you could say Louis Riel was the founder of Manitoba, I think. he was attacked by the Ottawa. The federal government attacked him, and he was actually hanged for treason, but he's now understood as being a hero and a founder of Manitoba, as far as I understand, anyway. So I have a few books on Riel. Should we revisit them? You assert that we need to let... John, do you have any comments or any questions you'd like to ask?
Yeah, this is about Louis Riel. Like, I think I heard, like, a couple years ago during COVID, someone had vandalized the big Louis Riel statue. So I don't know if he's, like, necessarily a hero, or if the people who vandalized the statue were... I don't know, had a racist agenda to it, or what that was about.
Yeah, no, I don't remember actually hearing that story, but I am certainly no expert in this area, and I know people talk about the different sort of epochs of understanding Riel, from, you know, traitor to just like we don't talk about him, and then trying to elevate his status. Yeah, and it's always a challenge. You know, when we want to have our heroes after they could have made an impact, it's sort of, you know, Martin Luther King is sort of similar, that we, you know, he's become a redeemed figure, but at the time, you know, the establishment couldn't really handle his message. And so, well, now he's gone. Now we can put him on a pedestal, kind of thing.
Yeah. I think there's a statue, and the statue that was created of Louis Riel was a very deformed-looking statue, which also drew criticism. It didn't show him; it showed him as a rather twisted figure. It was just an artistic thing. But
yeah, there's the two. Yeah, there's the very stately figure at the legislative grounds, and then there's the more internally interpretive vision at the. I think it's at the St. Boniface College.
Okay. You assert that we need to let the wealth be in service of the gospel or collective wealth in the form of accessible care and support. With the power of God flowing into the living, we have served God and not money. So would you explain that that assertion that you made?
Sure. No, I found, again, when I talked earlier about the parallels between religion and economics, it's very fascinating that there's several passages throughout the Old Testament that describe the effects of idolatry. And so they're always very critical. So you have this image of a god or of a human, but they're like, well, it's just a material form. But if you serve that, you're going to become dead like that form. And so the thinking there is that you'll know idolatry because it takes away life from the living. It makes things dead. And it's sort of the contemporary images might be it's extractive. It takes more than it gives. And we look at our economy in terms of the primary function is to create a profit. And so you're extracting from human labor, from natural resources, and so you're killing these things to create this image of profit. Whereas the idea of holiness, and I find this is often a misconception too, you know, in our society, holiness, we often have this idea of a very pious person who just does everything right, and you know, very clean, straight-laced. But holiness is really the idea that of God's life flowing into the world. And so whatever is life-giving is holy. And so that's sort of the reverse. And so whatever, you know, wealth we have and whatever resources, when that flows out to all people in an accessible way, that would be an example of holiness is what I try to work with there.
And you have addressed capitalism as having racist underpinnings, and you cite one author, Dedrick Robinson, having coined the word racist capitalism. So do you want to expand on that statement? Even though slavery no longer exists.
Sure.
Yeah,
and again, I should, you know, all of these things, I would want to qualify, like I talk about a lot of big ideas and themes in this book, of which I cannot claim to be expert, but I feel like they're so important. We have to be able to try to talk about them. And so whatever I offer here is as a invested kind of layperson trying to understand this. There's a Greek economist who I always appreciated, he said, you know, the economy is so important that it shouldn't be left to the economists, that it's something that everybody should try to understand because you have such deep investment in it. So my understanding of, you know, one way to understand racial capitalism is that basically the foundations of those who are in power and those who have established wealth are still directly tied to the fact that certainly, I mean, in Britain as well, but certainly in US and North America, its economy and foundation was derived directly from the ability to have slaves and the ability to appropriate land from indigenous people. And so that was sort of the foundations of the wealth there. And even if, you know, there's no legal slavery anymore, or you know, we're working at indigenous relations, the basis of those, you know, so you know, take my own situation, you know, for example, I'm, you know, part of a lot of the immigrants that came to Manitoba in the late 1870s, again, were part of a nation building project of establishing land. And so that, you know, I'm still learning the history of how the various ways the indigenous people were just sort of pushed and shoved and undermined in their relation to the land here. But we were, as Mennonite settlers, essentially given land and set up for success. And so now we have a much more secure material basis than others would. And so while I hope I am not a racist, there's a certain establishment that is has a racial or racist background that still has a deep impact today.
Yeah, that reminds me of a book I'm rereading again. It's called The Vikings, and it's about the Icelandic people and their settlement in Canada. And the Icelandic people, I knew, I had a very good friend who was Icelandic. I was I used to board at her place years and years ago when I was teaching in the town of Piney, if you can imagine. But I was very fond of the Icelandic people, and they were very sensitive to the fact that they realized that they were taking over indigenous land. And that accounts for a lot of some of the stuff, some of the lore they have and the ghost sightings. And they were very sensitive. And so they had to deal with that whole situation being brought to Canada as settlers and realizing that they were actually taking over indigenous people's lands. And a lot of Icelandic people intermarried with the Métis or the indigenous people. It's a very interesting, troubling situation for sure. The word idolatry, you talk about that in many respects, and you have addressed the idolatry of modern times in comparison to the idolatry of the Israelites of the Old Testament. So do you want to explain that?
Yeah, so it relates a little bit to what I talked about earlier as our tendency to want to concentrate and control the things that around us in life. So it's a very natural tendency. You know, obviously, it was much more pressing in the ancient world when you had a very limited sense of things like the weather or other large cycles. And so to the extent that, you know, you could have access to some realm that would have control in that. And so, you know, if you had an idol and you had the right practices, you believe there was might be some control. Whereas again, today, you know, that control is based on, you know, return on investment and profit statements and, you know, material basis. And so again, it's a very natural thing to want to have some control in our security. The challenge is that throughout history, that has come at the cost of too many people, that, you know, that it's, you know, a basis for warfare, that it's, you know, the concentration, unequal concentration of wealth. And so there's this wager in faith that if we prioritize collective well-being over individual security, that ultimately it serves the well-being of all of us better. But that's, you know, I've come to see that just works against the grain of a lot of human nature. And so that's a difficult task then, and it is still now.
Mm-hmm. You have a comment that a different understanding of the early Christian church Christian era emerges with making peace with Rome. A note adds that for Mennonites, Constantinism, or the institutionalizing of the church through the Empire of Rome, has long been held as a shorthand for the fall of the church. And I know I just have to comment, being a Roman Catholic, I understand that the Roman church, when you call it the Roman church, it is based on the power of Rome. Rome had a lot of power, and so the church had a lot of power. So I can see that similarity. But anyway, would you comment on this question?
Sure. Yeah, and this is certainly a distinctive, as I said, of my own Mennonite background, where over time, I mean, there was, you know, Mennonites and Anabaptists emerged through a deep kind of a thorough pessimism and skepticism about the world's structure of order and authority and power. And so there was a deep renunciation of that, whereas, you know, the majority of Christian expressions at that time held a certain responsibility for overseeing, you know, kind of the political order of their area. And so this would have been true in England with the Anglican Church, and in the early Protestant churches and the Roman churches, that sort of the church and state were deeply interwoven. And so, you know, Mennonites sort of trace that back to the church sort of making peace with Rome with Constantine when he converted. And so in a sense, there's, you know, a sense that there's an inevitability that if the church grows in a particular place, then why wouldn't its leaders also reflect that? But Mennonites have always held a very a critical perspective towards that, even though, you know, we also want the state to do things that we would consider aligned with the gospel. And so there's sort of a, you know, a contradiction and a tension to this thing. But it's, yeah, for Mennonites, we've always held much more of a critical, tended to hold more of a critical posture of our relation to the state in that way.
Yeah, and I think today we don't expect the church to really have much to do with the state. The church has its own mandate, and it doesn't control all aspects of our lives like it would have had in the past. It is said that you cannot. It's said that you cannot serve God and money, and that capitalism is built on a model of growth, the privatization of services and natural resources, and even the privatization of our time and leisure. You also state that the theology and liturgy of Christendom is explicitly supremacist. Do you want to comment on that?
Sure. Yeah. No. That's, there's a couple of bold claims in there, and I think that's just mostly reflective of my experience, both within the Mennonite church and in churches in general. And so it's not necessarily, you know, supremacist is a very strong word, and it, you know, we associate it very quickly with sort of white or nationalist supremacist movements. But for me, it simply means if we believe as a group that we already are sufficient in our understanding of something, that we don't need anyone else when we come into contact with a new group, then we believe, we essentially believe we're better than them, that we don't need anyone else to understand what is good about life and how to live it. And so that's just been my experience, that the church implicitly or explicitly believes that it's better than others. Fortunately, I still find that to be the case. And so whatever is good, you know, I noticed this even in simple statements. You know, when you think about whatever is good, it always flows from the church to the world, as opposed to the church receiving good news from other groups, and us being willing and humble to hear that and accept that.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting way of looking at it. John, do you want to do the station ID? Or
yeah, you're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM. This is Wooden Spoons. It's 8:44 a.m.
My, the time is going by quickly. Do you have any comments, John?
Not at this moment, no.
Okay. So, David, you comment on Sardai Harman's book, Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments, where she traces the lives of Black women and at the turn of the 20th century. Would you comment on the situation of the so-called freedom of Black women, freed from slavery, but they were still being abused?
Yeah, so that was, I just really valued and found that those expressions sort of, again, this is sort of that structural piece where, you know, you could fight for the legal abolishment of slavery, which, I mean, I cannot imagine, you know, discounting the types of freedoms and release. But, you know, under slavery, there was a certain responsibility by slave owners to the basic, you know, wealth, you know, the food and housing and whatever of slaves. There was a certain accountability, and with the abolishment there was an ability to say, you know, we have no responsibility, you're free, but now we're also the ones who control all the wealth, who have all the work opportunities, and so now you're still at our whim to, you know, whether or not we want to hire you and how we treat you. And so there was no, clearly no any sense of balancing out the type of power dynamics that would have been at play post-slavery. And so that book just really traces the lives of women often in difficult or impossible situations as they try to, you know, find their way in what was sort of a supposed freedom after slavery. It sort of, you know, relates to this idea of racial capitalism as well. You know, when, you know, Haiti as the first country to really legally overthrow slavery, and what did their freedom cost? So they, you know, they had to pay France in reparations for the slave owners' lost income. And so it was just this perverse sense of, you know, they were now indebted to slave owners for their freedom, as opposed to, you know, that they could now own sort of the means and the land and the ability to actually make a living after they abolished slavery. So
that is just unbelievable. I didn't know that. That just, and we wonder why Haiti is such a poor country and having so many difficulties. Anyway, we're getting close to the end of our interview, and a few more things I have to do this morning, but want to share this morning. But I thought we could end with, you had some interesting conversations with the Proud Boys, as you seemed to be a sort of undercover there when you were talking to them, so they had no idea. What did you learn about them and their impact on the world? Society.
Yeah, that was a very interesting time. You know, the Proud Boys itself was a relatively new movement, and so there was, you know, a chapter that emerged in Manitoba during a time when it wasn't, you know, it was certainly a controversial group, but not wasn't known to the way that it was now, and so yeah, I ended up connecting with a few local members. Yeah, like you said, I think I started off pretty anonymous, but as we talked, I was fine sort of sharing who I was, what I did, and being critical of them. And I think what I learned is that, you know, if what they shared was their honest views and opinions, and again, at that time, it wasn't quite as loaded where they might have been as more secretive, you know, I didn't find them to be much different than a lot of folks I have conversation with. And so that's not to in any ways minimize the impact and the motivation of that larger group, but it's to maybe acknowledge that its appeal reaches to, I think, a broader audience than we might suspect.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Proud Boys were also involved with the attack on the White House. Actually, they were spearheaded by Trump, I'm quite sure. They were in support of Trump. Anyway, thank you, David, for sharing all this information with us. It's very deep and rich in all the things that you say. And your book is, the title of your book is... what is the title of your book? I keep forgetting.
Nothing Will Save Us.
That's right.
A Theology of Immeasurable Life.
Yes. And how can people purchase your book if they want to read it? It's a very good, very good book.
Yeah, I know they were getting more physical copies in at McNally.
Some there, because I didn't see the book there.
Yeah, they haven't always. I think there was, sort of a bit of a back order there. A common word on the CMU campus carries physical copies, but both of those places you can make requests and order online, and it's available online other places as well.
Okay, well, thank you for joining us this morning, Dave, and I decided to that they we got the song. Did I give you the song, John?
You can give it to me now.
Okay. It's called Down to the River to Pray by Alison Krauss. It's a very beautiful song. And I thought this was a good way of ending our interview. And thank you so much, David, for joining us this morning.
All right. Thanks for having me. Okay.
As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown. Good Lord, show me the way.
Okay, take care.
Oh, sisters, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sisters, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the robe and crown? Good Lord, show me the way. Oh, brothers, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Come on, brothers, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown? Good Lord, show me the way. Oh, fathers, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, fathers, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the robe and crown? Good Lord, show me the way. Oh, mothers, let's go down, come on down, don't you want to go down? Come on, mothers, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown? Good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sinners, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sinners, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the robe and crown? Good Lord, show me the way.
We're back here, and I just want to mention that next week, Marianne Sorelli and Kaylin Spain will be having their program on Wooden Spoons, and it's titled Gravel Roads and City Lights. And I should have mentioned that earlier this morning, but things have moved on very quickly with our interview. So I will end with a recipe. I had planned to share some information from Dr. Meg Sears about glyphosate. I will do that next week, and also provide more nutrition information. Sometimes we have to just go with the flow. And here's a recipe for chickpea patties with herbs. And it's a very simple recipe with a vegan that adapts to different nutritional needs. So you might need 2 cups of cooked chickpeas. I prefer not using canned, or 1 9-ounce can, but if you get the raw chickpeas, just cook them yourself. 1 clove of garlic chopped, 1/2 onion chopped, 4 tablespoons of fresh parsley, or you could use 2 tablespoons of dried parsley, 1 carrot grated, and 2 large eggs, or using an egg replacer if you can't eat eggs. And an egg replacer is making an egg substitute from flax seeds. You just grind some flax seeds, add some water to make a thick paste. So you can use, and then you can also, instead of an egg replacer, you can use 1/4 cup of dry breadcrumbs. 1 teaspoon of cumin powder, 1 teaspoon of ground coriander, 1 teaspoon of salt or to taste, 1/2 teaspoon of black pepper or dried chili pepper or to taste, and 1/4 teaspoon of dried oregano, squeeze of lemon juice or to taste, and oil for frying. Using a potato masher or a food processor, mix the rice, chickpeas, garlic, and onion, and parsley. Transfer to a bowl and stir in the grated carrot, the eggs or egg replacer, and the seasonings. Mix well and form into patties. Place on a floured plate. Now, if you can't use flour, some people have difficulties with flour because of gluten. You can use, instead of flour, you can use chickpea flour. And that's a very good flour to use. It doesn't have gluten, and it provides a certain amount of flavor as well. So you fry on medium heat until browned on one side, and you turn over and fry the other side until browned. You continue cooking until the patties are firm and the vegetables are tender. Serve on a bun with lettuce and tomatoes and or with your favorite sauce. It could be a yogurt curried sauce. And one of the notes to take heed about is to cut the onions very fine. This helps to keep the burgers together. If you have bigger pieces, they could fall apart more easily. And and do not over-salt, since with moisture loss during cooking, the burgers will become more salty. So you have to be a little careful with that. To speed up the cooking process, you may sauté the grated carrots and onions to soften them before adding them to the mixture. And you can also add other vegetables to these chickpea patties. It's very versatile. You could add finely chopped kale. And so, again, you can substitute an egg with flax seeds that you make. And you can substitute wheat flour with chickpea flour because it doesn't have gluten for those that are gluten sensitive. Next week, I'll follow up with information from Prevent Cancer Now, and we will continue on with Wooden Spoons. Well, next week, we're having Mary Ann Sorelli, but the week after, so we're alternating. It's a bit confusing sometimes. I think, John, you got mixed up yourself.
Yeah, I thought Mary Ann was coming on this week, but guess not. All right, you have been listening to Wooden Spoon, sponsored by Mary Jane's Cooking School on CKUW 95.9 FM. For our podcast, please go to ckuw.ca, type Wooden Spoons in the search bar, and the show will be up in just a few hours. Till next time, this is John Dick and Mary Jane Eason saying bye for now, and thanks for listening.